Welcome to Truth Be Told. I'm Tony Sweet with Captain Ron. Today is a treat, one of our favorite guests that we've ever had on Truth Be Told. We have forensic geologist Scott Walter. Scott is bringing back America Unearthed on the Travel Channel, and we're so excited. Scott is going to be digging up surprising mysteries and secrets of America and tries to turn a lot of what we know about the U.S. history on its head. Yes, he's going to uncover compelling theories that predate the official discovery of the New World and finds evidence of the great lengths people have gone through to cover these mysteries up. But today on Truth Be Told, we're going to have Scott. We're going to talk about his bringing back America Unearthed on Travel Channel, and we're so excited. So please welcome back to Truth Be Told, the one and only Scott Walter. Hey, Scott.
You got a crowd there, huh?
We do. You know, we started this cheesy applause like 5.5 years ago, and it's just hard to get rid of it. I love it.
I'll just pretend like it's real, and I'll just soak it up.
Well, if I had that many hands, I would actually give you that many applause. So,
thank you.
Of course, but we're really glad you're back on air. Like I said in the intro, that American Unearthed for me. Ancient Aliens and American Unearthed were my favorite shows on History Channel, and now you're on Travel Channel. And I think it was because it just brought the regular guy that had the fascination, as all of us did as young children, that now we're adults and we still have that passion of trying to find out, you know, mysteries and legends and myths and bringing them to life. And I think that's why so many people have been drawn to these shows. So yeah. welcome back to the air.
Yeah, it's you know, it's sort of strange and surreal in a way, because you know, it's been about 4 years since we went off the air, and it was strange because, you know, it wasn't because we weren't getting good ratings and people didn't like the show. In fact, it was the opposite. Things were going great, and at the time we were the number one show on H2, and then all of a sudden they sold the channel. So it was sort of surprising. And I thought, you know, we might go to big history, and eventually they decided not to
go that direction.
Renew us, because you know why they, you know what they said?
What?
They said, because your show's too smart for history.
What?
That's what they said. It's what my agent told me. And it was really disappointing because, I don't agree with them. I think that people like to continue to learn, and you know, we can teach them things. I mean, that's part of what we try to do on the show,
right?
While we're investigating these mysteries and see where they lead. So I really don't agree. I think if you give people intelligent content, you know, done in an entertaining and you know, in fun way, they'll respond. I think people still want to learn and grow.
Oh, so. Yeah. Well, I think that's just a curiosity of a human species, that we, you know, we, even though we have a lot of doubt, you know, we doubt so many things that we hear from, you know, our ancestors, our government, whatever, we still have a knowledge that we, you know, of our existence and where we came from. And that was one reason I've always been a very big advocate, and just of knowing your family tree, of knowing where you came from, and because there's so many hidden gems in your past. And so what's going to be different going from, you know, one channel now to the Travel Channel? What was the big decision of, you know, okay, I'm going to do this, but this is what I want this time around?
Well, you know what? I honestly, I really didn't have a lot of complaints. I didn't really have any complaints.
Right.
You know, other than the big difference that I've noticed is that Travel Channel has really promoted the show way more than History ever did. And, you know, I'm not totally sure why, but I can tell you that their commitment has been 100% all in. They've been so great. They've supported me personally in anything or any way that I've asked them, and I really haven't asked them for much, but they've made it very clear that, you know, they will provide whatever support we need. But the promotion has really been phenomenal, and I can tell, you know, there's more buzz online, and my Twitter is really been busy, and Facebook and
right.
And Instagram. I mean, it's really they put a lot behind it, and you know, let's face it, they've made a significant investment.
Right.
You know, they bought the rights to all 39 episodes that we had already done, and they've been airing those on the show, building up the audience, and ratings have been great for that. I haven't heard how last night did yet, but you know, fingers are crossed, and I hope people enjoy the rest of the shows that are coming. They're really good.
Right.
In fact, I just watched one of the final cuts for an episode towards the end of the season, and I gave them the thumbs up. I said, "Looks good." You know, they let me look at them, and I have to sign off on them, and I signed off on it. I had really nothing to say. It was great.
Is there any topic that's off the table for you? Because there's a lot of conspiracy and, you know, mysteries out there, but is there any topic that you're like, yeah, that's too far for me?
Well, you know, I probably would have said that several years ago when I first started, you know, the first three seasons. And one of the things I said was off the table was Bigfoot. Another one was aliens. And I will tell you that we have an episode this season on both. And, you know, I guess to distill it down, one of the things that occurred to me is, you know, when it comes to things like Templars in America and,
right.
you know, Phoenicians coming to America, and a lot of the things that we investigate that, you know, we like to say are part of this hidden history or this narrative that's forbidden and we can't talk about, but yet I want to talk about them, right? And I want to bring this to the forefront. So the bottom line is that, you know, I ask people to be open-minded about the things that I think are important. I guess turnabout's fair play, right?
Right.
So, I use the phrase, well, you know, people need to be open-minded. Well, I guess that applies to me too, right?
Right. And we're getting a lot of questions in the chat room. I'm going to ask those here down the line. But I know a lot of the topics that you have on this season, how did you go about getting those? Do you have a say in the topic for each episode, or did they go out and actually do the research and then just present it to you?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I would say probably a third of the episodes are what I call my stuff, my ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say a third is the production company, Committee Films, who does a fantastic job. And the network, you know, they come in with ideas and they say, hey, these are some things that we want to do. And, you know, the alien episode and the Bigfoot episode were not my ideas. But I have to say, one of those I just watched was one of those, and I thought it was great. So I guess being open-minded pays dividends sometimes, right?
Right. Well, the episode one last night was about the,
yep.
the Viking ship. So can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, because who would ever have thought that a Vikings would have been this far out? I mean, I'm here in Los Angeles, so it's pretty dang close to me. So could you...
Right, right.
Can you talk...
Well, you know where the Salton Sea is.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, if there was a Viking ship or any other ship from any other culture that came into, you know, the Gulf of California there around Baja, you know, you go back 1,000 years, you could potentially sail right into what is now the Salton Sea. They called it Lake Kaweah back in those days. But, you know, it's and let's be honest, I mean, Vikings in the desert is almost, it's an oxymoron in many ways. You know, it doesn't seem to make sense. But,
at all.
I mean, the artifacts that were found are absolutely legitimate Viking-era artifacts and older. So it's a collection of artifacts that are 100% authentic. The big question that we investigated is, how did they get there? Now, again, I'll be perfectly honest with you, and I think realistically it comes across in the episode that the most likely scenario probably was an immigrant that came to the United States in the late 19th centuries, 20th century, maybe even the early 21st century, who knows, and brought these artifacts as a collection,
mm-hmm.
and somehow they made it into the desert. I mean, that's probably realistically the most plausible scenario,
mm-hmm.
but The other possibility is that they're older than that, that they were brought here by Vikings that were exploring in the southwest region. And you have to remember the climate was a lot different, you know, 1,000 years ago, and there was more water there. The Salton Sea was Lake Kaweah, which was many times larger than it is now, and drained into the Gulf of California. So it's very plausible, and so we looked at, you know, the evidence that there is to see if there was a connection. And I thought it was a really fun episode. I think it was plausible, and hope people liked it.
Well, I mean, everybody in the chat room saying it was a great episode, but what kind of pops into my mind, where it seems like when we find a lot of answers, it just begs more questions.
It creates more questions. Yeah. Absolutely.
And how do we ever become to a determination something is even close to 80% correct? Because, you know, I think one thing I like about you, you're still a skeptic, because until you have evidence, it's not like, because there's a lot of people out there, you know, they read something online and, oh, it's real. It's 100% real. But with you, I like that you know, not that everybody has the luxury of going to these places and researching and interviewing.
Right.
But how can we, in 2019, determine something is 100% real? Because, you know, there's been a lot, many thousands of years we've been here, and how can we determine something is legit?
Well, that's a really good question, and I've asked the same question myself. You know, in my world, I work in the professional scientific world, not the academic world, and, you know, their bar of, you know, the threshold you have to meet there is, you know, consensus among, you know, I don't know what it is, 75%. I don't know if it's you're ever going to get 100% consensus where people agree on a conclusion that somebody reaches. In my world, I have to be prepared to testify under oath in a court of law.
Wow.
to my findings. And quite frankly, I think that's a higher bar. But you take things like the Kensington Runestone. I had somebody that just wrote to me before I called and said, well, the runestone hasn't been definitively solved. Well, yes, it has. I mean, the evidence is 100% in multiple disciplines consistent with authenticity. There isn't one piece of factual evidence against it. And how can there be if it's authentic? I mean, there can't be any evidence to support the alternative. So, but again, it gets back to this question that you asked. Who decides?
Right.
When does it become accepted history? When, you know, the president makes a statement? Well, obviously not. When it's published in a book? Well, I published it in a book, but apparently some people don't think that's good enough.
Right.
I don't know who makes the ultimate call. You know, some would say maybe the academics are the ones. The academics are the reason we have this problem in the first place.
Exactly.
Why would we trust them?
Well, I mean, if it's true, if you think about it, you know, I'll be 50 this year, and things that I've learned when I was, you know, in the 70s and 80s in school and in high school are so far from what I learned to what's known today. So it is. It's very confusing for a lot of people out there. And I can see where people love what you do and love shows like this because they get to learn. But it's also it puts a division between our academics and politicians because we hear complete opposite. And so I think shows like this, that's why I think shows like this are very important for society because, and people like you, I love like that you go in with a skeptic eye and walk away going, I think this is a possibility, but it's not 100% conclusive. So,
well, there are going to be times you will hear me this season say, I am 100% convinced that this happened or that this is real or this is not real. And one of the things that I have no problem saying unequivocally, and that is that the Templars came to America, you know, prior to Columbus. There's no question in my mind.
Right.
The Kensington Runestone is just one piece of many that is consistent with that. And in my mind, it's proven. Now, there are a lot of questions. You said it before, once you make a statement about something or a conclusion is reached, it begs more questions.
Right.
Well, this is certainly one of those, but I'm ready to attack them. I'm ready to answer a lot of them,
mm-hmm.
and go after the ones that we don't have answers for. But this is a really, really important thing. It goes to the very beginnings of the founding of this country that people don't realize. And honest to God, I think we've got it pretty much figured out, the basic story, and now we're just filling in the details. But it's a huge story. It's important. And I'm ready to say without any hesitation, they were here, and they were responsible for founding, for beginning the founding of this country.
That's awesome. And of all the episodes you've done, and you've done quite a few and a lot of topics, has there ever been one or two that really have impacted your life when it comes to your decision about a topic? Has there something that just changed you? Like, you know, sometimes somebody's in a car wreck and their life has changed. They you know.
Right, right.
Has there been an episode or a topic that you've researched that you just walked away and go, wow, this is, my whole view is different now?
Well, yeah, the Kinsey to Runestone. I mean, right from the get-go, that was the first thing that started me on this journey that eventually led me to where we are today. And, you know, I at the time, you know, I was an expert in concrete and rock, and I didn't even know the Runestone existed.
Hmm.
And, you know, once I got into it, I just attacked it. I didn't know that there was a historical paradigm that you don't tread upon. I didn't know that the world had deemed this thing a hoax without any factual evidence, I might add.
Right.
But it was just not acceptable. And, you know, I did my work and I came to my conclusion based on what I thought was some pretty damn good science, and so did the people that reviewed my work. And, you know, I threw my results out there and I wrote my report and I thought, well, good for them, they got one, and I'm just going to move on with my life. But it was the negative pushback that I got back. And it wasn't people saying, well, no, we disagree with you because we think you did this, this, or this wrong, or we disagree with you on this point, which I'm certainly happy to engage anybody that has questions. And I'm not above making mistakes either. If I made a mistake in my research, I want to correct it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not about me being right. It's about getting the right answer. And so I was ready for that. But that's not what I got. Basically, they just didn't like the answer, so they tried to claim that I was a pseudoscientist, that I didn't know what I was talking about, and, you know, all of this negative stuff. And, you know, for a while, I was confused, and then I got pissed, and that's what
you don't want to piss God off
to dig to the bottom of this well.
Yeah, I remember we had you on the last time, and I remember you did a story on the Masons. And shortly thereafter, didn't you join the Masons?
I did.
And what? I'm sorry, but I was just going to finish this question real quick. That what was it about doing the research that really enthused you to say, you know what, I think I'm going to research this a little bit more and become one?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, it was two things, really. One was, as I was doing more research on trying to figure out who carved the Kensington Runestone, where did they come from, and more importantly, why did they come here?
Mm-hmm.
I followed the evidence trail. It went straight to, and nobody else, but the medieval Knights Templar Order. It was the easiest evidence trail I've ever followed. And I laugh when people say, oh, well, you're just going after the Templars because it's cool and it's sexy. And
right.
No. If you look at the evidence, they are the only ones that had the means, the money, the motivation to do this. And like I said, it was the easiest evidence trail I ever followed. So, you know, that was, and then, of course, when you follow, you get to the Knights Templar, you know, the Freemasons are right standing there with them. So I really spent a lot of time trying to understand both, because I saw so many parallels and connections between them. And, you know, the other thing that sort of pushed me over the edge to become a Freemason was my dad was a Mason.
Hmm.
But I didn't find out he was a Mason until the day after he died.
Wow.
He drowned in a diving accident, and they they cut off his ring that he always wore, but of course I never looked at because I was in my early 20s at the time. And they gave it to me, and I looked at it, and I'm, you know, I mean, obviously I was pretty upset at the time, but eventually when I got home, I pulled the ring out, and I said, "Mom, what is this?" And she said, "Oh, your dad was a Mason." I said, "Well, what's a Mason?" And, you know, so I found out that I came from, my family has a fairly long tradition of being Freemasons, and he never talked about it. And I think the reason was maybe I wasn't ready. And I can tell you that I really wasn't ready mentally and emotionally and spiritually to become a Mason until just a few years ago, because, you know, I was a young, cocky guy who knew it all already, right? You know, you really can't become a Mason, truly a Mason in your heart, until you get kicked around by life a little bit and realize I needed to be a little more humble. And that took some time. And when the time came, I was ready. And it was absolutely the best move I ever made. And you will read in my new book that one of the degrees that I experienced in the York Rite degrees was the final, provided the final piece to the puzzle to solve the Kensington Runestone. And it was the one thing that was missing.
Mm. Well, Tanya, I'm going to just ask this question from the chat room. Tanya was like, now that you're a Mason, are you restricted in what you talk about concerning Masons?
Absolutely not. The only thing that I cannot talk about are very few things, but really very few. I mean, I can't talk about handshakes and secret right. words and ancient penalties and things like that. But you know what? If you really want to figure it out, you can go online. But you know, in Masonry, what they say is, you know, if we can't trust you for keeping the secrets of passwords and you know, handshakes and things like that, how can we trust you with more important things, right?
Right, exactly. And I know there's a lot of people, like, I'm going to bring something up because I'm from Kansas originally, Granola, Kansas, real small town in Kansas, but mm-hmm. really close to there, they're in Ark, Kansas City, we call it Ark City, they found an ancient Indian city. I don't know if you've heard about this, and it's called Etzanoa. There was, they claim
that, yes, I have heard of this.
Do you take requests? So if anybody sees, you know, something in their area or a myth, or and do they, how do they submit, or how do, because I'm sure
you're... Well, the way you mean submit a tip?
Yeah, a tip. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I mean, this episode we had last night was a tip that came in, you know, during season 3, and, you know, we were doing well, and we thought, you know, we're going to do a season 4, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
It just didn't happen because of what we talked about
right,
earlier.
Right.
But that tip came in from Harry Atkins' father, who unfortunately passed away about a year and a half ago. But Harry, you know, he stepped up to the plate in honor of his father, and he was a tipster that brought those artifacts to our attention. So if people want to send in a tip, they certainly can. And I apologize, I don't have the email handy right now, but if they want to send a tip to me at my personal email at work, they can do that. You can just Google my name, it'll come right up. SWalter@amengtest.com, and they can send it to me, and I'll forward it to the production company. And you know, there are some that come in. I go, you know what? I'm putting a bullet on this one. I really like this, and it doesn't guarantee that it'll get, you know,
right.
picked up, but they will take a long, hard look at it if I like it.
Now, what have you ever had a tip that didn't make air, but you said, you know what? I'm going to go anyway.
Oh yeah, many times. I'm doing that right now. And it doesn't mean that it might not get to air at some point. It just means that they're not ready to do it. And, you know, there are a lot of things that are out there that I would love to do it. You know,
right.
Unfortunately, I'm not going to live probably long enough
right.
to do them all, or the show probably won't last that long. But, you know, the things that I think are really, really important, I always follow up on. And, you know, if they're important to me, they're probably going to be important to the audience and the production company, the network recognizes that. So if I think something is worth pursuing, there's a good chance it'll make it.
So let's go back to the Ark City. So when you hear when you hear something like this, we had Giorgio Tsoukalos on yesterday, and we were talking about...
Oh, Giorgio's a good friend. Sent me a nice text a couple days ago. He said, you know, break a leg and wished me well. And I have to tell you, when I first knew of, you know, Giorgio, I thought he was a little bit of a chucklehead. But when I met him, he was a great guy. He was very smart. He's a really good person, and he wasn't at all like I imagined him to be, right? And, of course, that's the danger that we all have to be careful of, is prejudging people before you meet them.
Exactly.
And I just had to give a shout-out to him because he's a really good guy, and I consider him a good friend.
No, you both remind me of each other because you're not stuck in your ways, but you have integrity in what you do. So, because we were talking about how a lot of people in this field of, you know, ancient, you know, astronaut theorist and, you know, the History Channel, a lot of these people, what they do is they go with trends. So they change their mind as trends change, but you guys both stay the same. You stay on your course and stay on your path. So that you do remind me of each other. But what we were talking about is there is a human species that was found in the Philippines. And I asked him, does that excite you? Because as what we're trying to do is finding out, you know, especially on, you know, UFO and alien side, how that influenced, you know, human species and human history. What has been discovered that excites you when it comes to what you are looking for and what you're researching? Is there anything that's came out in the last year or so that really just said, wow, this is a game changer?
Well, you know, Tony, there's stuff coming out constantly. And, you know, in the last 5-10 years, there's probably been more exciting new discoveries, new research that's come out and really, you know, turned what, you know, the whatever that particular artifact may relate to, but things are changing. There's so many new discoveries that are happening now that are really just, you know, whatever we thought we knew before, you know, you can just throw it out. We need to rewrite the whole thing. And in many ways, I feel a little bit vindicated because, you know, I've always said that, look, there's a lot more going on here than we know. And just when you think that you've got it all figured out, boom, something's going to come and just, you know, knock you over. And so that's why, you know, I use careful language most of the time. You won't hear me say definitive statements too often unless I really feel like, you know, something has been proven, because just when you think you've got everything figured out, something new comes along and boom, you know, Clovis is gone now, right? So then now it's the Solutrean culture, and I guarantee you they're going to find all kinds of things that are going to push, you know, human evolution and discoveries back even further, and who knows what kind of changes and new ideas are going to come from these discoveries. So I think it's just smart to hedge your bet, because, you know, just when you start to think you got it all figured out, you're going to realize you don't.
Right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and take some questions from the chat room, because
go ahead.
This is Scott Walter, by the way, if you guys are just tuning in. Scott is a forensic geologist, and he is the host of American Unearthed, now on Travel Channel. And he is seriously kind of an inspiration for many of us that have always wanted to seek the truth, because we knew what we were being taught was not the truth. And that's one of the reasons I started Truth Be Told, because there were so many people that I learned throughout history in my 50 years on this planet that I said, that just doesn't seem right to me. Something just told me. And Scott is one of those people that go out, instead of just saying it doesn't seem right, I'm going to prove that this is wrong or this is right. So, all right. So Justin in the chat room, he wants to know about ancient Templar maps to America. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, there are all kinds of ancient Templar maps. Most of them are probably sitting in the Vatican archives. They were hidden by the order and they're sitting in either a monastery or a commandery someplace, but some of those maps have come forward. you're going to see some of the maps, I think, might very well be authentic copies of original Templar maps from their explorations over here in North America. They're part of something called the Cremona document, and they're incredibly detailed. Some of the maps that we're aware of, we are not publishing yet because there's some pretty incredible information on them that we're just not going to make public yet until we have investigated, we've looked into them.
Right.
But, they kept very detailed records. They made incredible maps. They were master navigators. They understood, how to get around. They knew the world way more than people think they did. And I think evidence of that is the Kensington Runestone that's sitting right in the exact geographic center of the continent. I don't think that they placed it there as a land claim, and it was a coincidence that its location is where it is. And if it is exactly in the middle of the continent, what that suggests is they knew how big it was. And the only way they would know that is because they had explored it, and they knew. So are there Templar maps? Absolutely. Some are available, some are not, but more will come out down the road.
Why do you think the Templars have and Masons have lasted so long? Because so many, I guess, what quote secret societies have, they come and go,
they don't last. Yeah.
But why?
Well,
why
you know, do you think so? Go ahead.
No,
sorry,
I just
Tony.
Said, why do you think they last so long?
Well, I think if when you become a Mason, and the Masons that are listening out there will know what I'm talking about. The craft is ancient because its core tenets are about essentially making good men and good women in other orders' case better. And the allegory that we use is something called the rough ashlar, or a roughly cubical shaped stone that's very rough on its edges.
Right.
And that represents an initiate or somebody who is beginning their journey in masonry, just a regular person that is, still a sturdy piece of stone, but it's rough around the edges, if you will. And as you go through these degrees and you learn more and more and you're taught these moral lessons, the other symbol is what we call a perfect ashlar. It's a square stone that's polished with its sides straight and true. And the whole idea is to make this rough ashlar into a perfect ashlar, make this person into a better person, and then that finished stone, that better person, if you will, that finished stone then goes into the larger structure and serves its purpose as one of the foundation stones that helps hold up this entire building or structure. And the allegory there is this better person goes into society to help make a better society. And it's a beautiful allegory, and really I think that sums up Freemasonry, in a nutshell. And, who doesn't want that?
Right.
That is a message I don't think anybody can argue. We all want a better society. We want our people to be educated, to be helpful, to be compassionate, and those are the things that we're taught in Freemasonry, along with a bunch of other stuff. And I can tell you that when I shake a guy's hand and I realize that I'm shaking the hand of a brother who's gone through the same experiences that I have, we're automatically at a level above anybody else who's not a Mason, because we share some common experiences, but more importantly, we share common values. And it's just a good thing. And, good things that help make, improve the lives of people in society are going to last a long time.
So there's a lot of people that connect, I never understood this, but connected the New World Order and the Masons. Can you explain why they connect those two, and are they? Which I know the answer to this.
Well, I think the answer is simple on one level, and what I mean by that is, are we a secret society? Well, it depends on how you define it, right? We're really more a society with secrets, and you know, I hate to break it to people, but, you know, we don't have a command center where people make, you know, decisions that right. affect the world, you know. It's pretty funny. We have at our Scottish Rite Temple, we have what we call our 33rd room where the guys, you know, our 33rd degree Freemasons, which is an honorary title bestowed to people that have done, you know, outstanding work somehow in the community or within the craft, as we call it. But we have a 33rd room, and and when we give tours and people come in here, we joke and say, yeah, well, this is where all the decisions are made that you know, about what's going to happen in the world. And one guy joked and said, yeah, and we decide who's going to win the Super Bowl every year. And the guy said, well, how come you guys don't ever pick the Vikings? That's really mean. But anyway, obviously we're joking. But right. No, there is no New World Order connected to, you know, within Freemasonry. Now, having said that, are there societies out there, New World Order type societies, that do make decisions that impact the world? I would say the answer to that is yes. Are some of them Freemasons? Probably. But is it a Freemason organization? Absolutely not. And I'm just telling you my opinion.
Right.
Please
right.
don't take that like I'm saying I know something, because I don't.
Right.
That's my speculation.
Well, I'm gonna switch a little bit, because this also ties into the Masons, but they also want to know in the chat room, what about his knowledge of you, Scott, of ancient Egypt's navigating to the Americas?
Well, on one hand, why not? I mean, the navigation knowledge existed. There were people in the east there in the Mediterranean region that knew all about the New World, in my opinion, no question about it. However, you know, I don't think that the Egyptians per se mounted an expedition and came on their own. They probably hired out the Phoenicians, who had the ability to sail the oceans, and used them and hired them out for trafficking goods and so forth during that time. So I think if the Egyptians came over here, they probably hired out Phoenician boats and came over here.
All right, one more question, and then I want to go back to the show before we get you out of here. But what is your thoughts on giants in America?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't think we've really done enough for me to say one way or the other on that topic. My mind certainly remains open. We just haven't delved into it as far as we need to for me to say anything more definitive. It's a topic that we did look into briefly, but it begs more investigation on my part. And, you know, this is one of those areas where a lot of people suspect that the government is keeping secrets from us, and they might be right. You know, I don't understand why something like the Bat Creek Stone, that was discovered by the Smithsonian Institution, a government entity, right?
Right.
They dug into that Cherokee burial mound, and they discovered that artifact, but they didn't realize what it was when they found it. And my interpretation of that is that they didn't think it was a threat to the narrative. So they went ahead and cataloged it, published it, and then forgot about it until the 1970s, when it was realized it wasn't a paleo Cherokee inscription. It was paleo Hebrew, first century paleo Hebrew. And when that was realized, something very interesting happened. The Smithsonian Institution, our nation's museum, right? We depend on them to be scientific, to do, you know, honest, legitimate investigations. You would think that their reaction to this would be, wow, that's interesting. We need to investigate this. No. They came out and said it was a hoax, and they blamed their own field agent, John Emmert, the guy who discovered it, working for the Smithsonian, of doing it.
Hmm.
Now, that's BS.
Right.
And then when we did episodes on the Bat Creek Stone, and I came out and said it was genuine, they came on my blog to make an official statement.
Did they really?
And then I called them out, and I said, well, wait a minute. If you're going to accuse your own field agent of planting this thing, then you have to call in all 200 digs that he did for the institution into question as well. And if you're so incompetent that you hire a guy like that who's making fraudulent artifacts, what about the rest of the guys that did those, you know, those mound excavations? You call your entire mound excavation program into question when you make an unsubstantiated accusation about somebody who's been dead for a century. Mm. And so they came back, they modified their conclusion, and they took John Emmert out, but they still said it was a fake. That is just crazy. And we're supposed to trust you guys?
Right.
Sorry.
No, right. Well, that being said, I mean, you think about, you know, the Smithsonian, the Vatican, and tons of other institutions out there that have so many answers to our history in their vaults. Why, Scott, what does it matter if, you know, Columbus didn't discover? What does it matter if, you know, so many things that may have happened? Why does it have to alter our history so much?
I'll tell you why. Look, you know, we don't have to be specific, but every one of us at some point in our lives, usually when we're young,
right,
tell a lie.
True.
And then it comes back to haunt you, right? You know, it's easier to tell a lie and make a problem or a difficult situation go away, especially when you're young, only to have it come back and bite you in the rear, right?
Right.
That's exactly what happened here. I mean, it was easier to say, well, we're going to pick Columbus, and this is the official start, and this is going to support the narrative of Manifest Destiny. Manifest Destiny basically was composed, and I'm oversimplifying this, but essentially it was item number one. The Native Americans are savages. And this is an age-old technique that everybody has used throughout time. You take a group of people and you dehumanize them by calling them a derogatory name to justify persecution, right? We do that with women. We do it with ethnic groups. We do it with religious groups all the time. Well, not we, but I'm talking about just people in general.
Right, right.
And, you know, and that gives you an excuse to treat them any way you want, to get them out of the way for whatever reason. And that's what happened with Native Americans, and let's just call it what it was, and the word is genocide, right?
Exactly.
And the reason we did that is we didn't want to have to honor treaties. It was easier just to kill them and do what we want. The other part of Manifest Destiny was essentially the statement that, you know, it is our God-given Christian right to take this land, because this is free for the taking, because all there, you know, there's only savages here.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, that was essentially the policy. And so, you know, saying there was nobody here before Chris helped to justify that policy. Now, what do you do when all of a sudden something like the Kensington Runestone land claim comes into the picture? Do you sit there and go, oh, wow, gee, well, you know what, maybe we made a mistake. It wasn't a mistake. They knew exactly what they were doing from the very beginning. They knew it was a lie. So what do we do with something like the Runestone that absolutely proves that we were lying? Well, then you got to tell another lie, right?
Right, and it's hard to break
and
it.
And it's a hoax, okay?
Yeah.
That's a lie.
Right.
So, I mean, you get the point.
No, I get the point. In fact, me bringing up the Indian city with over 20,000 people in Ark City, Kansas, proves a point. Is how can 20,000 people, and possibly more, it ran like a democracy or a city of, you know, stores and, you know, merchants and everything.
Wait, Tony, you're talking about people that are civilized.
But that's
right?
What I'm saying.
That's
why it disappeared.
Because they were savages, right?
Right.
You can't have that. So this whole idea that they were living as communities,
right,
and operated, maybe they even had government. Do people know, do people realize that the basic foundation of our governmental system with the separation of powers is based upon the Iroquois system?
Really?
Of how they operated? Yes. Look it up.
Fascinating.
And Ben Franklin was especially fascinated with how they organized. And you know who were respected in their culture? Women. They sought their counsel.
God forbid.
And, you know, pardon?
I said, God forbid.
Oh, God forbid. Heaven forbid that, right?
Yeah.
And this goes to the core of one of the things that's also been suppressed about the true nature of Templarism. The leaders embraced a different ideology than everybody thought. They weren't the good Catholics that everybody thought.
Right.
You ever heard the phrase, keep your friends close, your enemies closer?
Oh, yeah.
That's exactly what they did. They aligned with the Roman Catholic Church with the ultimate goal of eventually taking it over. The church had borrowed or stolen, depending on your point of view, all the symbols and symbolism of this ancient Templar tradition that goes back thousands of years through Egypt and beyond. So it was easy for these, what we call Venus families or Templar families, to adopt these symbols and pretend to be Catholic and embrace somebody like Mary, right?
Right.
The question is, which Mary are you talking about? And so this is really goes to the core of this, but really what's really important and was missed by everybody is that their reverence for the sacred feminine aspect of the Godhead was huge, as it was with Native Americans. They are mostly matriarchal cultures. They embraced a similar ideology. So when the Templars came over here, they shared that ideology. They had that core belief system in common. And that's why they were so successful over here. They didn't fight their way to Kensington, for crying out loud. The natives brought them here. And if they brought them here, they brought them all over the continent and who knows where else. But this was the common thread that they shared, and this was missed by everybody, or it was intentionally suppressed. Probably the latter.
Right. And I find it fascinating, and then we got to get out of here because I know you got so many other things to do. But
I got a softball game tonight, man. I got to get loosened up.
Oh, there we go. Okay. Well, I find it that we will fight to preserve a building for historical significance, but we as human beings and society of America and other countries have wiped out a complete society and didn't even blink an eye. And
it, think nothing of it.
Think nothing
well,
of it.
You know, it's a matter of priorities, right?
Right.
What is important to different societies and groups of people? And, you know, the other thing that we are taught in Freemasonry, and I think it's a lesson for everybody, and it's one of the things that I really, really like about the craft, and that is when we take our obligations on the altar inside of our lodges, there's a Bible there, there's a Quran, there's a Torah. If there's a Buddhist there, we'll put whatever holy book they want.
Right.
Native American brothers will take their obligation on an eagle feather. And the only thing we ask them to do is to make a statement in a belief in a higher power. We don't care what you call it. We don't care what its name is. Hmm. Just that you believe in that higher power. And the bottom line is regardless of what faith you embrace, we're all talking about the same thing.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Nobody's God is any better than somebody else's God. And the other thing that I think is really, really important for people to understand that I think, quite frankly, is where organized religion takes advantage is you don't need a priest or rabbi or anyone to help you get to your creator. You can have a relationship with your deity, your God, whoever it is, yourself. Because at the end of the day, it's about your relationship with God. And that's nobody else's business. Now, if you want to share it with other people in a place like a church or a synagogue or a mosque, good for you.
Hmm.
But why can't a Christian go to a mosque? Why can't a Muslim go to a Jewish synagogue?
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, you're doing the same thing. And instead of criticizing people for honoring their deity in a different way, why don't you pay attention and learn?
Right.
You know, I'll just say one last thing. I was asked to be the officiant at my son's, one of his best friend's wedding. They were here last night, Joe and Marissa, to watch the show with us. Joe is Jewish, she's Christian. And so I had to figure out a way to incorporate, you know, rituals to honor both sides of the family, and we did that. But I also introduced another ritual, a Native American ritual. And what it was a Hopi marriage pot that has two spouts on either side.
Hmm.
And basically I asked them, I said, are you guys okay with this? And at the end of the ceremony, you know, my wife and I gave the vessel, it's a clay vessel made by the Hopi, to them. But basically on one spout, you fill it up with whatever drink you want. In this case, it was rum. And, you know, the bride takes a sip, and if she's so inclined, she'll turn the same spout to her groom and offer him to take a drink. Then I filled up the other side. I gave it to him. He took a sip, and if he's so inclined, he will offer it to her. And if everything goes well, which it did, then I fill up both sides, and they have to drink it together at the same time.
Wow.
And it was a beautiful ritual, and I was a little bit nervous about the father of the groom because he was Jewish, and I don't know why, but I just go, geez, I wonder what Bob's going to say. And he pulled me aside afterwards, and he said, that was so beautiful, Scott. I loved it. But, you know, this was a really great opportunity to incorporate the rituals in a marriage ceremony of three different traditions. And everybody there loved it, and I think learned something from it. So that's a lesson I think that we should all just sort of take to heart and think about, especially when we live in such divisive times. And instead of, you know, criticizing and being fearful of other people's traditions and what they look like and what they do, maybe you should be more curious and ask questions and learn from that. It's really cool.
Either that or watch American Unearthed on Travel Channel on Tuesdays.
All right, that sounds good. I'll take that.
Well, Scott, this is why Scott is one of our favorite guests, because he brings it, and he's real, and we enjoy that and appreciate that. So, Scott, thank you so much. Congratulations on having your show back on Travel Channel. Keep in touch, and hopefully we'll have you back soon.
Absolutely, Tony. Enjoy the rest of your day, and thanks to everybody for listening to the show and watching our show last night. And keep watching. We got more good stuff coming.
And win in the softball.
Hey, we'll give it our best effort, but you know what? At the end of the game, we all go to the bar, have a couple beers. We're all winners afterwards, right?
That's right. That's right. That's all that matters. So, all right, thank you everybody, for tuning in.
Tony, take care, man.
We'll talk to you soon. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. We really appreciate you. Go to subscribe to our channel. Share this episode. We really appreciate it. But until next time, I'm Tony Sweet with Captain Ron for Truth Be Told. Talk to you soon.